Okay, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome once again. So this is going to be our final technical lecture. We do have a lecture tomorrow, which will be a discussion and advice about how you approach the exam and your revision and so on. So you don't want to miss that, do you? Yeah? Okay, good. So I'll see you tomorrow. But stay here for this one as well, please, because I've prepared for it, so you know. Okay, of course the microphone is not working again. I don't know, it's a random variable and I've no idea how to get the thing to work. So if you can't hear me at the back at any stage, do please, shout out or something, or look unhappy, or look more unhappy than you usually do. That will work, okay. So we're going to look at ranking queries on the web. We're not going to do this to full depth, of course. We're only going to do the very beginning of these ideas, and we're going to do a kind of toy version of it, but that gives you a start. And if you wanted to follow this up, it's a much longer study, as with all these other things. Okay, so with that caveat, let's proceed. So suppose we have an inverted index for a set of web pages. Okay. First of all, let's just have a disclaimer. In the last lecture, we looked at how to index very large amounts of data, but we had a convenient fiction that I used without comment, which was I assumed that we could hold all the data on one disk. Well, of course, that ain't going to happen with the web, you know. Even with the world's biggest disk, you're not going to hold anything like a fraction of all the data you get by crawling the web and collecting, you know, all kinds of terms. So the real situation is you've got loads and loads of machines working in parallel on loads and loads of disks. But we made a step in the right direction with the discussion there. Okay, so I hope that's clear enough. Okay. Anyway, suppose we've got our index built, and we're interested in one particular search term, T. Okay, and let's say it has 36,000 entries in the index. Well, and somebody wants to see the entries. Well, if you just dump them in front of them and say, here you are, 36,000 entries, what's the use of that, you know? There have to be some notion of, well, here's the most relevant, the next most relevant, the next, and so on, okay? Of course, we know that in reality, that's going to be an approximate notion, you know? It's what you think is most relevant and what I think is most relevant is not going to be, you know, necessarily the same thing, but there's got to be some kind of big overlap there, okay? So that's the most we can hope for, and that's pretty useful anyway. Okay, so how should we rank such queries? Let's just see the problem in action. So I always do this example because I'm always in search of God, and where else would you find God but on the internet, like everything else, okay? So this is a query, I think last year, just out of interest's sake, I did the same search just before the lecture. And, well, look at that number there. You know, that's how many results were returned about 40 minutes ago, or whatever it was, you know. Last year it was a bit less, I think, but still it's a huge number, you know. How do you rank so many things? You know, what's the thing? One interesting observation. Every year I do this example, Wikipedia is the most authoritative source on God. And then next is God's own website, god.com. It's really there, and it's always the second. This really amuses me, okay? Maybe this is why I haven't found God as fully as I would like to, okay? Anyway, you see the problem, you know? It's a huge problem. All right, so let's just make an observation. If we have an inverted index, then it will probably store the frequency of each term in each document. Well, probably, I mean, we can ensure it does, you know, we do the search, so we can ensure it does that. If we want to use that information, we can ensure that our search actually stores that information, okay? So one possible approach to this would be, well, what's the difficulty? Rank queries in order of frequency of occurrence in each document, you know, and. Well, there's an obvious problem with that, which is, some very relevant websites don't store that many occurrences of the term. For example, if you do University of Edinburgh as your search term, now, the University of Edinburgh website front page doesn't have that many occurrences of this term. It doesn't need to, you know. But clearly, it's quite relevant to your search, you know. So if you rank them according to order of frequency, it's you're going to get some very weird results. And also, if you do it this way, you're then encouraging people to build awful websites where they put their term, you know, loads and loads of times just to rank high. So obviously, as an idea, this is a non-starter. You know, it has lots of things wrong with it. For this application, you know, for other applications, it may be the most relevant thing. Okay, but for this application, it's clearly not a good idea. Okay. So a different idea is to use the structure of the web to rank queries. Okay. So you're ranking them by looking at the kind of global situation, okay, rather than just locally for each page. Okay. So the principle that underlies this idea is the notion that if you have a link from one web page to another, then that link is saying this page is worth going to, you know. Otherwise, why have a link there? Okay. And therefore, it's conferring some kind of authority on that second page. Okay. And this is an idea that occurred to various people. Okay. For example, there's a model called the Hub Authority Model by Kleinberg, which uses this idea. And maybe more famously now, because of commercial success, really, the PageRank algorithm of Google uses a similar idea, just implements it differently, but it's the same idea. Okay. So this was started off famously by two PhD students who went on to found Google, and the rest is history, as they say, okay, which is fine. Okay, but I don't want to give the impression that therefore this idea is the final word in these notions, or it's the very best idea. It's the one that's become most successful. Fine. Okay. So we're going to look at the PageRank algorithm, at least a toy version of it. Okay, to start with. Okay. So how do we implement this notion? Well, we can think of the web as consisting of a graph. Of course, the web pages are vertices of the graph, and the edges are links from one page to the next, and they're obviously directed edges. Okay. So let's think of the web pages numbered 1 up to n. N is very big, of course, but it's some natural number. And links will be directed edges from, you know, taking pairs of vertices. Okay, so a simple idea. Okay, let me just remind you. Okay, if we have a graph, vertex set V, edge set E, then if U is a vertex, then capital I n of U denotes all the edges that are going into U. So diagrammatically, if this is your vertex U, then in U consists of all those edges that are going, pointing into U, obviously, yeah? And lowercase I n of U denotes the number of such edges, okay? And then there's a similar notion for out. The edges going out of U denoted in a similar way, because that's just reminding you of a notation that we've seen before. Okay. And adjacency matrix, again, you'll recall, I hope, the idea of you know, you put one in entry ij if there's an edge from vertex I to vertex j. Okay. When I introduced this notation, we were numbering from 0 up to n minus 1. What I've just done is number vertices from 1 up to n. Well, you're growing up enough to cope with that and know you should adjust the indexing, yeah? Okay. I haven't bothered to adjust it for you. I put it to you that you can handle that. Okay. If you can't, why not? Okay. So that should be simple, okay? All right. Now, we could use the in degree into a vertex, a web page, to measure ranking directly. Okay. So you could say, you know, just count how many edges are pointing to you, so how many references are there to you, and that gives you a certain rank. Now compare that and just rank the pages according to that count. Okay. Is that a good idea? You can see that, first of all, it encourages people to create rubbish web pages with loads and loads and loads of links to their own websites to try and raise the rank. So that's obviously not going to be a good thing, okay? And really, you want to say, well, if by some process of ranking, you're a high-ranking page, you know, it's been agreed that this page is really, you know, very useful, and it points to something else, then presumably that ought to confer a bit more authority to that something else than if a very low-ranking page points to that something else. So you want high-ranking things to confer more authority to other stuff they refer to than low-ranking things. Yeah, that seems to be a reasonable kind of way to proceed. Okay. And if you think about ranking as being some constant you've got, when you're pointing to other stuff, you're kind of sharing out your authority to all this other stuff. Now, in the absence of any other criterion, let's say that you're sharing your authority equally amongst the other things. So if I'm pointing to you, you, and you, and my rank is, let's say, 10, you each get a third of that ranking as my contribution to your ranking. Okay, clear enough idea? So if I have a small number of links, I'm giving you proportionally more of my authority than if I have a huge number of links. Okay, so that's the kind of notion, okay, going on here. Okay, now, some technical assumptions, which we'll see coming to force later on, are that, and this is why this is a toy version of the algorithm, but this can be taken care of, okay? First of all, we assume that there are no dead-end pages, so every page points to something, okay? Also, that you can go from any one page to any other, so the web is strongly connected. If you start from somewhere, you can get to anywhere else by sequence of links, maybe a very roundabout sequence, but you can get. The third assumption here is really very technical. We assume that the underlying graph is aperiodic. Now, what the hell does that mean, you ask? Or do you not ask? You do ask. Yes. Okay, thank you. At least one person wants to know, so you will all have to know now. It's, as I say, it's a very technical condition. What it means is the following. Look at the lengths of loops in the graph. So count the lengths of fundamental loops. Okay, so cycles. Okay, yeah. Take the greatest common divisor of those lengths. Okay, so that's the biggest number that divides them all. If the greatest common divisor is 1, your graph is aperiodic. If it's anything else, it is not aperiodic. I told you it's a very technical condition. Okay. Notice that what this means is, for example, your graph has, say, a cycle of length 3 and a cycle of length, let's say, 10. You know it's aperiodic already. You don't need to look at any other cycle. Why? Because the GCD of those two numbers is already 1, so it can't be anything other than 1 when you take the others into account. Okay. We'll see how this comes in later as a technical condition. Okay. All right. So let's now have a little bit of notation. Let's suppose R of V denotes the rank of the vertex V for a web page V in our graph. Okay. What conditions should hold between ranks? Well, so I'm vertex V, let's say. Okay. And let's say I'm pointing out to here, to these other web pages. I'm comparing to each of them an exact proportion of my ranking. Okay, so how much am I contributing to the pages I'm pointing out to? Well, it's my rank divided by the number of edges that are going out to me. So that's the size of out V. Yeah? And each of them gets this same amount. So that's how much I'm sending to the rest of the world out there that I'm seeing directly. And so, okay. Now, of course, others are pointing at me. So let's say U1 points to me, U2 points to me, and so on. Let's say UM points to me. So I'm collecting authority from those. They're sending me, you know, some credit. How much credit am I collecting? Well, by the same principle, this person is sending me their rank divided by their out degree. Okay. So what I'm collecting from this person is the rank of U1 divided by the size of out of U1. Okay. And likewise, all the way down to here. The rank of um divided by the size of out of um. Okay? Yeah? And that's the only way I can get credits. Right? So my rank of V, that's me, must be just the sum of all these here. That's the only way I can get any credits. Up to M, I said, I think. Okay. Which is just a long winded way of saying exactly what the rest of this slide says. Okay. I think I've got U instead of V, my apologies. Anyway, it doesn't matter. The rank of a vertex U, any vertex U, should be equal to. Well, you look at all the incoming edges, so that's V in U, okay, so that's all vertices that have an edge going into U. Okay. You take the rank of V and take it proportionate to what is sending to U, that's its out degree divided by its out degree. Okay, very simple idea, right? So that's the condition we require the ranks to satisfy. Now, when you see that condition, you should feel pretty pleased. Why? Because it's a very simple condition. It's a set of linear equations amongst unknowns. If you think of the ranks as unknowns that you're trying to fix, okay, they only occur to the power one everywhere. And you know these things here, you know the out degrees, okay? They're fixed. The only things you don't know are these ranks. So you have a simple set of linear equations. You have much better than that, actually. Okay, so let's see what you have that's better. First of all, let's just re-express this in the familiar vector matrix notation. Okay, so this is just re-expressing the set of, all those equations for each vertex. We've got n vertices, rank 1, rank 2, up to rank n. It's just precisely this thing here, where each pij is just 1 over the out degree of u, where v is in the out set of u. Okay? That's just exactly these equations, just corrected into one matrix notation. Okay. The familiar vector matrix notation for a set of linear equations. Nothing new here, just a convenient notation. Okay. But notice one thing. Okay, if we travel along the row, let's say this row here, what entries do you see? If there's a excuse me, if there is an edge from vertex 1 to vertex j, let's say, then vertex 1 contributes so much authority to vertex j. How much authority? 1 over the number of outgoing edges. Okay? So each entry along here is either 0 or 1 over the out degree of 1. Okay? So what is the sum of all the entries there? Precisely 1. Right? Because you have, if the out degree is m, you have m entries of value 1 over m, and then the rest are 0. Well, m times 1 over m, the last time I looked, was 1. Yeah? That apparently trivial observation turns out to be very important. Okay. So we can write this in shorthand notation, of course. R transpose is R transpose times P. I want to think of R as a column vector. Just now it's a row vector. You're used to this from the learning thread anyway. Okay, so nothing new. Except I'm going the other way around, but never mind. Okay? And, well, I want to solve this equation, but that's just exactly the same as taking the transpose of each side. I still have exactly the same equation, just thought of notated differently. So what I'm trying to solve is R is P transpose times R. Okay. Now, when you see that, if you have done even a trivial amount of linear algebra, you think to yourself, hang on a minute, that's looking for eigenvectors. In this case, with eigenvalue 1. The set of eigenvectors of a matrix, you're looking for mx equals lambda x, okay? Where x is your vector and lambda is your eigenvalue. X is the eigenvector, lambda is the eigenvalue corresponding to that. And of course, you insist that x is not the zero vector, because that's always a solution. It's of no interest. You're looking for non-trivial vectors, that do this job, okay, for very good reasons. So here we have exactly that situation where we fix the eigenvalue to be 1. Okay. Clear? All right, good. Oh, before I move on, now you see the value of taking mathematics seriously, I hope. If you haven't seen it before, you see it now, okay? I was once talking to a fellow mathematician, and he observed something rather astute. If civilization had to pay royalties for all the uses of linear algebra that have been made, it couldn't afford it. That is literally true, if you think about it. Yes. Linear algebra underlies so much of what is done in engineering and science in general that it doesn't bear thinking about. Okay, so it's a good job that there are no royalties. Okay, move on. Some questions and answers now. So we have the setup. We know what we're trying to solve. How do we know it has any solutions at all? You know, it's what we like, but it may be inconsistent. There may be no solutions at all, in which case this model is sunk. Okay. Well, first of all, P transposed is a stochastic matrix. Which means precisely that its columns add up to 1. Remember, the rows of P add up to 1, but P transposed, you know, rows of P become columns of P transposed. So the columns of P transposed all add up to 1. Okay. Any such matrix is guaranteed to have an eigenvalue 1. Okay. May have other eigenvalues, but it has 1 is an eigenvalue. Okay. Maybe I'll sketch the proof of that for you, actually. Let's do that. Okay, it's not part of the course, not in the notes, but let me just sketch the proof of that, because this bit is not obvious, but it's not difficult. The rest of it is not obvious and it's not easy. So let's do the not obvious easy bit, and then leave the rest of it for those who want to go and look at the relevant sources. Okay, let me just show you how simple this claim is. Okay, I've got a matrix which is stochastic, so its entries are A11 up to A1n, A21, A2n, An1, Ann, and I'm trying to solve the equation, I'm going to take lambda equals 1, but for now let me just use lambda because I want to illustrate the general thing first, okay? And the only thing I know about this matrix is that the sum of each column is equal to 1. Okay. I'm claiming that if I know that, then I know that there is a solution with lambda equals 1. By solution, I mean, of course, that at least one entry of these vectors is non-zero. It's a non-trivial solution. Okay. That's what we're looking for. Otherwise, there's always a solution. Just take all the x is equal to 0 and it's trivial. Okay. It tells you nothing about the matrix. It's true for all matrices. That's why you dismiss it as a solution. It's of no interest. Okay. Well, solving this system here is exactly the same as solving the system. I should have left myself some more space, but let me just cheat. I get rid of this sign here, replace it by zeros. And here I have A11 minus lambda, A22 minus lambda, and down here ANN. That's exactly the same system. Okay. I've just taken the variables to the other side and written the coefficient matrix out. That's a triviality. Okay. Convince yourselves at another time that this is really trivial. Okay. So what I'm asking for is, does this homogeneous system now, homogeneous because the other side is 0, okay, have a non-trivial solution? Right. This is exactly the same as asking, are the the columns of this matrix linearly dependent? Can you find a combination of them, a non-trivial combination of them, which adds up to 0 in every entry? But the columns of a matrix are linearly dependent if and only if the same is true for the rows. That's a standard theorem of linear algebra. Not a triviality, but it's a standard theorem. Okay? But you see, if I put lambda equals 1 in this matrix, then my rows are certainly linearly dependent. Why? Because if I put lambda equals 1 in here, add up these row entries, what do you get? Well, the sum of these A's is 1, and you get minus 1. 1 minus 1, last time I looked, 0. Yes? Likewise there, likewise there, likewise there, okay? So it certainly has a solution with lambda equals 1. That's a sketch proof of the claim, okay? Very simple fact to know. Okay. All right, so the fact that this is stochastic assures us that there is a solution with lambda equals 1. Okay. But we're not finished yet. That's reassuring, but it's not enough for us to get a usable situation. Okay. We've said if one, but we know one is an eigenvalue now. Here's a sketch proof, okay? But suppose that there were several different possible eigenvectors. Okay. Now, we have to be careful about what we mean by several different eigenvectors. Because if you've got a solution, let me just now switch to a compressed notation to make it simpler. This is where you distinguish those who understand from those who are parroting, right? I'm not interested in those who parrot. You have to understand deeply. Okay. So let's understand this point. If I said I'm looking at this equation here, I fix lambda and I'm looking at the equation. If I said naively, oh, but I want x to be unique, why is that a stupid requirement to make? That is just cretinous beyond belief. Why? It's unbelievably stupid. I have been known to be that. Okay, so, but why? I'm asking for the impossible. Right? Why? Because if there's a solution like that, then n times 2x is also a solution. Because it's linear. Double all your variables, it's still a solution. Multiply them by any constant, it's still a solution. Right? So it would be unbelievably stupid to say I want x to be unique, but it makes sense to say I want x to be unique in the sense that any other solution is a multiple of x, right? That then makes sense. So it's in that sense that we want uniqueness, okay? That there should be one eigenvector and all others are just multiples of that eigenvector. To put it in more posh terms, the vector space spanned by the eigenvectors has dimension 1. That means exactly the same thing. Okay. Now, that is not assured by what we just did, the black book before I rubbed it out, but it is assured by the other conditions we assumed about our underlying graph. And that's not obvious, okay? I'm not going to even try to sketch it. Okay? But those other conditions do ensure that we know there is at least one eigenvector because there is an eigenvalue, okay? And it's non-trivial. The other conditions tell us there is exactly one eigenvector in the sense of this discussion here, that anything else is just a constant multiple of it. Why would we be worried if there were two distinct eigenvectors, one is not a multiple of the other? Well, which ranking would you take, you know? You can understand, you know, if I've got an eigenvector 1/2 and 3, and another eigenvector which is twice that. They're giving you the same ranking, really, just scaling up or down, right? But if I also had the eigenvector, let's say, 3, 1, 0, well, there's no way you can scale this to be that, or vice versa. So which one would you take as your ranking? That's what would be disastrous, to have more than one eigenvector where more than one is in this sense of up to constant multiples. Okay. So if it turned out we had more than one eigenvector, then this model is sunk. Okay. Or at least you'd have to do something else to fix it. You couldn't just go with it as it is. Okay. However, those conditions we made earlier on ensure that this is the case. And those conditions didn't originate with these people. Stochastic matrices have uses in all sorts of areas, probability, Markov chains, et cetera, et cetera. And these conditions have been studied by loads of people long, long before the web was even a glint in anybody's eye. Okay. This is not new mathematics people are using. This is very, very old mathematics. going back a long way. Okay. Which is another moral lesson. In the staff student liaison committee, which has lots of fun, somebody raised the point that we do this maths in the maths department, and it's not always, you know, it doesn't come with examples and, you know, how, where to use it and so on. Well, you know, when these people did this mathematics, they never thought it would have this use. Never occurred to them, right? If we try and motivate everything you do at every stage, we won't even get past the motivations. You have to have some faith that we're doing it for some good reason. Maybe just to make you suffer, but, you know, that's a worthy enough cause in my view, right? But usually there's something else going on in the background as well. I'll give you another quote. G.H. Hardy, a famous mathematician, who wrote what in my view was a dreadful book called The Mathematician's Apology. I really despise the book. He was a great mathematician, but the book I think is just, you know, awful. But anyway, one of the things he says in there, he did number theory because at least it has no uses whatsoever, so nobody will ever put it to any morally dubious effects. Well, number theory underlies cryptography nowadays with a vengeance. And if you're telling me cryptography has no morally dubious uses, you're not living in the real world, okay? Anyway, end of that, right. Let's get on with this. Yep. Where was I? Okay, here, yeah. Okay, so now let's look at a simple example of this, okay? Just to make everything gel, okay? Let's take the web as it was maybe 1 millisecond or billionth of a second after it was created. Maybe it was like this. Who knows? Okay. Obviously unrealistic, but, you know, it's enough to illustrate the ideas. So we've got 4 web pages with links as shown here. This satisfies all our... this is, of course, the result of a query. I mean, there may have been other pages which were not relevant to our query. Okay. We can check that it satisfies all the requirements. Okay, for example, it is certainly aperiodic because there's a cycle of length 2 there, and there's a cycle of length 3 from there to there to there. Okay, the GCD of 2 and 3 is 1, so it's aperiodic. And all the other conditions are easily seem to be satisfied as well. Okay. Now, writing down our equation for the ranks, we get this equation here. And this is very easy to write, by the way. We're indexing this by U, V, W, Z. Okay, so traveling along the row for U, if there's an edge going out from U to something, you need to put the right amount of rank there. How much is the right amount? Well, how many edges are going out of U? Count them, 2. So when you travel along that row for U, you should be seeing either a 0 or a half, right? You see a 0 if there's no edge from U to that vertex. You see a half if there is an edge from U to that vertex. And that's exactly how we built this matrix, okay? Another handy thing to understand, you know, when you're building these things, understand them in those kinds of terms. If you try to remember row UV where U ranges over alt degrees and blah, blah, oh God, you know, by that time you've already freaked out, right? Understand it in these very solid hands-on terms and you're doing fine. Understand them in both terms and you're doing really well. Okay. All right, so that's our equation. We can solve it in various ways. For example, from this equation here, we can read off the RW is RZ over 3. Just look at that there. Okay, if you multiply this into that, you just get RU, RV, and RW disappear, and you just get 1/3 of RZ. But that's the third entry. That's the entry for RW. So RW equals 1/3 of RZ. Okay, nothing clever going on. Just reading off the equations. Okay. So we can propagate this into the rest of the matrix, so all the contributions of RW become 1/3 of RZ and so on, okay? Proceed in that manner. And now we can remove RW because we know what this value is. It's 1/3 of RZ, okay? So that reduces the variables to just 3, okay? You can proceed now. To subtract RZ from RV, which changes your matrix to this here. This is nothing other than elimination done by matrices. Okay, I'll show you the familiar version in a minute. And from that, you can proceed to deduce that RU is RV is RZ, and RW is 1/3 of RZ. Okay, now it may be easier for a human. This is all right for a computer to manipulate these matrices and so on, but for a computer for a human user, it may be easier to write the equations out in full. In the familiar version, okay, this is exactly equivalent to the vector matrix notation, but it's maybe a bit easier to take on board for the human brain. So from this set, we already see, of course, that RW is the third RZ. That's exactly what we deduced first, okay? But it strikes you much more easily now, seeing it in this longhand version, okay? If we subtract, you can see that subtracting the second equation from the first is going to be a good thing. Why? Because if you do that, you're going to kill off half of RW and the third of RZ. So you're going to get something between RU and RV. Okay. So let's do that. And we get RU minus RV is a half of RV minus a half of RU, from which you, of course, deduce that these are equal. Okay. This follows immediately from that fact. Okay. And now, substituting into the fourth equation, we've got everything else in terms of Z now, so we can be finished, okay? My apologies, we get that everything else in terms of RU, and we can now get RZ in terms of RU, okay? Very simple, you know, just solving linear equations, which I hope is a familiar situation to you, okay? If it isn't, then you're sunk, okay? Well, if it isn't, make sure it is, right? I mean, you know, it's a triviality, okay? Right. Gaussian elimination, at least two or so centuries old, you know, catch up with the times, you know? Yeah. Even I know it, you know, come on, you know, yeah? Okay, nothing clever going on here, okay? All right. So, to sum up, our solutions are, as indicated, in both the versions of solving the situation. So we have that RU, RV, RW, RZ is just some constant times 1, 1, 1 third, and 1. Okay? So that tells us that the rankings are that RU, RV, and RZ have equal rank, and RW has lower rank, 1 third. Okay? And if you just go through the example, you see that if you were to rank these pages by in degree, you would get a different ranking. Okay, it's not the same. Right? It's conceivable that it might have turned out to be the same. Right? We didn't prove it's different, but here is a proof that this rather more, you know, elaborate way of obtaining ranks is not the same as counting in degree. It might have turned out to be the same, in which case it would be a bit silly, right? You wouldn't do it this way. Right? But in fact, it is different. It is more sensitive to the situation than just the naive notion of count in degrees and rank according to that way. Okay. Okay. Now, of course, in general, we don't have all those assumptions holding, but it is possible to tweak the model so that things work. You can no longer work with a situation where the eigenvalue is going to be 1. Okay. So what they do is find the largest eigenvalue. Okay. That you can build into the model, okay? And then the various other assumptions can be kind of tweaked by making various reasonably realistic assumptions about what is going on, okay, in the model. Okay, there's some details in the notes which I'll leave you to read in your own good time, but don't worry too much about it. I'm not taking the general model as being something you have to know a lot about, because, to be honest, to do the whole thing is beyond the scope of this course, right? It's just not really feasible. But this is the gist of the idea is what we've seen today. Okay? And this is a typical way of building something very complicated. You start off with some idealized, simplified situation. Say, how can we cope with this in a way that is not too tied down to it? Okay, you may have to make some assumptions about this situation now, which later you may have to remove. But for now, let's just try and get something going. Okay? And then later on, well, if we've got something that looks like it's a good idea, as this thing certainly does when you do it for more and more examples that meet the assumptions of the original naive model, you see that you actually get quite good results, you know, useful results. You could come up with loads of versions of ranking. The only criterion is, do they give you anything that is remotely useful, you know? And that you'll always find people that quibble. You say, well, you know, that should be higher than that. Sure, you know, you're not going to find a model that satisfies everybody or even yourself all the time, but as long as it satisfies most people most of the time and doesn't do anything truly ridiculous, it's okay. And it's got to be workable, Okay, so you're going to have approximations in this. Okay, so this is how they proceeded, really. You know, you start off with this idealized model, you see that it's producing, you know, rankings which are actually quite credible and quite useful. So it's worth working with this model to generalize it. You put in some tweaks into your model to make things work in the general situation. And if that's still working fine, then you can proceed with it. And that's really what's happened here. Okay. Now, unfortunately, neither of the course books discuss this situation. But there are some sources where you could go and look if you want more information. But you're not required to do so. I must stress that these are purely optional places where you could find more information if you wish to do so at some future stage. But not right now. You have more things to do right now than this. But at some future stage, you might want to do that. Here are some possible starting points. There'll be lots more, of course. Okay? All right. I think we deserve a 10-minute early stop today. Tomorrow, as I say, we'll discuss approaches to revision, the exam, et cetera, et cetera, and a question and answer session if you have any questions. Okay, so see you then. Thank you very much. You could tweak it that way, and you know, so you could weigh these, obviously, so you could buy some equations. I don't know if anybody has done that. I mean, obviously, Google don't tell us, you know, everything they've done. I suspect, you know, I don't think they apply just the algorithm.
But could it turn out to be super hard, or is it?
Because I think, well, you could make it super hard, obviously, but you know, if the idea was, well, when I write out this equation, I'm going to just have some scale factor which then when I say this is worth twice the other one, that's just a matter of altering the equation, so it's no harder than the original. It's just the hardest thing is to decide what scale factor to use. But you know, if you were then to start making quadratic and so on, then forget it. Then it's impossible. As long as you stay with linear, you're okay. The only hard thing is to decide what to choose.
And is the scientist citation in this score as a computed similarly, or?
I don't think so. I don't know how you do that. The citation index is based on, well, no, it's based straight on, you know, if a paper refers how many references there are to it. You know, so it's a different kind of thing for me. And it's an easier problem, so because you know, you simply count them. So many references to this paper, so that's the same.
But is that the index of the paper or the scientist who had
I think it's indexed to the paper.
Okay, yeah, that is different. Yeah.
And it's an easier problem.
I felt really stupid that it's like a waste of time, but I really just wasn't effort. And it's Pontus, or?
Well, okay, I'll present. It's not my decision. So, I've told you what I've said to Guido. The exercise is very good about finance. But, yeah, you know, if you decide on one of the.
Okay, I can prove that I haven't visited.
But you can see the difficulty because, you know, if we set conditions and they're not met, it gets a bit silly.
Right.
I wouldn't assume it necessarily works after the very heavy stress testing that is done by the board.